Our next guest has provided us some terrific insight and info. Great work for ESPN 710 in Seattle, online 710sports.com, on Twitter. It's at the B. Gustafson. Brandon, how are we doing now that the Ides of March are here?
Yeah, the old saying with spring training is hope springs eternal for all teams, right? So got the Mariners going now. They just wrapped up. I think they're wrapping up their second spring training game right about now, where that might have just concluded. But yeah, we're two games in. Pitchers and catchers have been there for quite a bit. So yeah, let's get it rolling.
You know, I want to start with football. So you have the greatest player in franchise history, maybe this side of Cortez Kennedy. He signs off on the Dan Patrick Show. Doesn't say go Hawks. Expresses some frustrations. And with a team-friendly salary cap number, and I saw what you posted today, like, oh, so now they're going to trade him for Taysom Hill and the 26th pick. What's the reality here? I mean, the buzz, any chance shy of just an historic package that Russell Wilson is not Seattle's quarterback in 2021?
I would bet that he is the Seattle Seahawks starting quarterback week one. I just think that based on the information that we know and that his camp has made public, it just doesn't seem feasible that he's moved by the beginning of the season. He hasn't asked for a trade yet that we know of, but he said, well, if I were to go along with a trade, because he has a no-trade clause, the four teams would be the Dallas Cowboys, the Las Vegas Raiders, the New Orleans Saints, and the Chicago Bears. Of those four teams, the only team that could realistically put together any sort of package close to what Russell Wilson would be worth would be the Cowboys if they were to be able to re-sign Dak Prescott, either on the franchise tag or a long-term deal, and they have a top 10 pick. Those three other teams, the Raiders, the Saints, and the Bears, they don't really have the draft capital to get Russell Wilson from the Seahawks. Derek Carr with the Raiders is the only guy that, you know, the Seahawks could take aside from Dak Prescott that would be worthy of being a starting quarterback. Those other two teams, the Bears and the Saints, just don't really have that. And what we know is the salary cap's going down by about $15 million this year. If the Seahawks were to trade Russell Wilson before June 1st, they'd be eating $39 million this year against the cap. It'd be almost a fourth of the cap space to pay somebody to not be on your team. It just doesn't seem possible. I think that the frustrations that he has are valid, but I think ultimately he's going to see how this season plays out with a new offensive coordinator, see how the offseason goes, what moves they make before he ends up trying to get out of town. It makes a lot more sense financially and just realistically that if a trade were to happen, it'd be next offseason and not this year.
All right, folks. So Trubisky for Wilson straight up. We're going to eliminate that from our vernacular.
Yes, please.
You know, talking about the offensive line, Mikey Potty, who missed six games this past year, retires at age 33. He's been a great player. He's been to Pro Bowls, been an All-Pro, only with the Hawks for two seasons, but he was a starter from day one. So what's the word? Are they good with Jordan Simmons taking over at guard? Are they going to look at free agency or the draft? Because now there's a little bit of a hole there.
Yeah, they actually have two spots on the offensive line that they're going to need to address this offseason. As you said, Mikey Potty just retired. He announced that last week. And Ethan Posick, who was a first-year starter for them at center this year and played pretty well, he's hitting unrestricted free agency. So you have those two interior line spots that need to be addressed. Obviously, with Russell Wilson's comments about being upset about, you know, getting sacked and hit so many times, he's going to want them to go out there in free agency and get a notable name. There's some good left guards out there. Joe Tooney with the Patriots is one name to kind of keep in mind. As far as centers go, Corey Linsley with the Packers, he was a first-team All-Pro this year. He's hitting free agency as well, and it doesn't sound like Green Bay is going to be able to keep him. But right now, the Seahawks only have about $3 or $4 million dollars going for them in terms of cap space. They're going to need to clear some room, whether that's extending players, restructuring contracts, cutting some veterans, in order to open that space up. Otherwise, they're going to have to look into the draft, but then again, with the draft, they don't have a first or third round pick this year because they traded for Jamal Adams. Right now, they only have four draft picks. So In terms of beefing up the offensive line, they've got a lot of work to do in order to either accumulate more high draft picks or to create space to go out and sign somebody that's notable.
Talking with Brandon Gustafson of ESPN 710 in Seattle, a last Seahawk question. To an outsider, it always seemed that Russell Wilson and Pete Carroll look like a solid relationship. I mean, Russ is elite. And let's face it, the past decade plus, Pete Carroll is the best coach and not wearing a hoodie. You think there's a real problem there or just a little bit of a rough patch? Because, you know, you do run into that danger of testing that grass is greener theory.
Yeah, and with Pete, it's funny because Pete is definitely seen as a player's coach, and he's seen as somebody who has his players' backs. And he was one of the first people to be outspoken in support of Russell Wilson back in 2012 when he was a rookie, and he ended up getting that starting quarterback job. And he was playing with a team with the Legion of Boom and all that, those great players on defense who had a lot of respect for Tavares Jackson, who was the quarterback the year before, and he was somebody that team really liked. And honestly, I think a lot of those guys wanted Tavares to be back as a starting quarterback Russell's rookie year. But Pete's always had Russell's back, and Pete's let his players voice their displeasure before. Marshawn Lynch did a lot of weird stuff. Richard Sherman was always very outspoken. Earl Thomas and Cam Chancellor all held out. Obviously, some of those relationships didn't end the best way, but Pete's definitely let his players voice their concerns. But one thing with this relationship right now is that Russell supposedly is upset at Pete's direction with the offense. He felt like they took the ball out of his hands a lot towards the end of the year, which really wasn't the case if you look at the numbers of pass-to-run ratio. But at the beginning of the season, they were high-flying. They were scoring all these points. Towards the end of the season, they kind of got figured out. So instead of staying stagnant, Pete went out and he hired a young, innovative offensive coordinator in Shane Waldron, who's coming from the Rams. And Russell had a say in that hire. Waldron made that very clear during his preliminary press conferences. So that's part of the reason why I don't think that there's any way he gets moved this year. I just don't see how he could help them get this new offensive coordinator on board, only for him to jet out through a trade a few months later. I just don't see that happening. Ultimately, I think that they'll get in the building and Pete and Russ will smooth things over as best they can. But again, I think that any sort of Russell leaving Seattle conversation is something that we're going to talk about maybe next offseason.
You know, I agree so much. It's ridiculous. But as far as the Mariners, there was a big story last week. Jared Kelenic and former team president Kevin Mather, you know, kind of like the Cubs and Chris Bryant 5 years ago. Will he get called up? Will the clock start towards arbitration and free agency, or let his development continue down on the farm? I thought you did an awesome job presenting kind of both sides. Let's start with what would be the benefit of delaying his MLB debut.
Obviously, you're going to look at service time first because that's kind of what's been put on the, you know, put under the microscope, right? You would have an extra year of club control if you're the Mariners. You would have Jared Kelenic's rights through the 2027 season instead of 2026. And this is a team that expects to maybe not really compete for a playoff spot this year, but next year. And if things work out, you know, 2025, 2026, those are going to be years where a lot of these young top prospects that they have in a really good farm system are going to be up there and going to have a few years under their belt. So that's one thing. But also, when you compare Jared Kelenic's eventual debut to some of these other top prospects, you brought up Chris Bryant. I think it's important to understand that Chris Bryant was somebody who, he was the number two pick in his draft. He was he was the best hitter in college baseball, and that's the important thing. It was college. He had more years of development than Jared Kelenic did when he made his debut. Chris Bryant was 23 years old, I believe, when he debuted for the Cubs. Right now, Jared Kelenic is 21 years old.
Right.
And another thing with Jared Kelenic is he has 92 plate appearances at the AA level, and he put up decent numbers. I think he hit about .253 with a few home runs, but under 100 plate appearances at AA, and he's not tearing the laces off the baseball, you know, and that was in September of 2019, August of 2019. It's been over a year since he's seen live pitching up until spring training that wasn't from his own team. We just haven't seen him against elite competition that isn't within the Mariners' own system. So there's a lot of things that go towards keeping him down. I totally understand fans wanting to see him. I understand Jared Kelenic's frustration given Kevin Mather basically admitting that the Mariners participate in service time manipulation, which is something that this next CBA absolutely needs to get rid of when they go about this next offseason. But I think there's a very strong case to be made that he should absolutely start the season in the minor leagues. Will that happen? That remains to be seen. Strong camp will help, and something that works in his favor, too, is the Mariners weren't able to go out there and get a veteran left-handed hitting bat to play outfield, so his competition at that spot really is pretty weak.
All right, there's your point-counterpoint for Jared Kelenic as we talk Mariner baseball with Brandon Gustafson of ESPN 710 in Seattle. So with a full season hopefully pending, obviously the rotation is critical and has to upgrade. Justin Dunn, once upon a time the Mets' first round pick, came over in the Robbie Cano deal as a rookie, made 10 starts. I think as you tweeted and noted, control issues. So he was told to go to work this weekend, this offseason, or risk his spot. What are we seeing so far that might be encouraging?
So last year, he was somebody who was sitting 90 to 92 miles an hour with his fastball. And just sitting at home, you know, by myself watching it on TV, I was like, that doesn't seem right. He was billed as this guy who didn't have the best fastball in the world, but he was low to mid-90s with a tight slider. That was kind of the scouting report with him. But the velocity just wasn't there. His curveball and his slider kind of blended together. His changeup was a little too firm. It looked too similar to his fastball. And he had a 4-1 record with, I think, a 4.34 ERA, but you looked a little past that, and it's like, yeah, he didn't really deserve those those numbers. He struck out only 38 guys in about 45 innings. He walked 31. He was not missing bats at all. He wasn't finding the zone, and guys were hitting him really hard. But Scott Servais hopped on one of our station shows this morning and made it really clear that Dunn took those words to heart. They basically told him at the end of the season, yeah, you have a lot of work to do if you're going to be in the rotation next year. And they went out and they signed James Paxton and Chris Flexen, which only put more pressure on Dunn. And he apparently he's looking a lot stronger. His velocity's improved. Scott Servais said that he was sitting 92 to 96 in his last live bullpens, and the off-speed pitches were looking a lot better. I'm interested to see how he looks in his first actual spring game, because those were just in live batting practice. But I think they're going with a six-man rotation, which helps his odds of starting the season on the MLB roster in the starting rotation. So I think ultimately we will see him in that sixth spot. But, yeah, he definitely does have a lot of work to do to rebound from a pretty rocky 2020 showing, all things considered.
Couple final thoughts for Brandon. You mentioned James Paxton, been with my Yankees the last 2 years. His first year, great run the second half. Then injuries cost him most the last year. But despite what the ex-boss Mather said, apparently he had some options. So what did Paxton have to say about returning to Seattle? And after 2 years, seeing almost like a new roster and perhaps taking on a leadership role.
Yeah, it's kind of funny you mentioned that. He's only played with, I believe, three players that are on the current roster.
Wow.
With Marco Gonzalez, Mitch Haniger, and Kyle Seager. There's been a lot of turnover since James Paxton was traded. And Paxton's trade to the Yankees back after the 2018 season was really the first big trade that the Mariners did when they started this rebuild. And they got Justice Sheffield, who is now going to be James Paxton's teammate in the starting rotation. So that'll be fun to see. But he's made it really clear that he's excited about having a leadership role. He and Marco Gonzalez are definitely the two de facto leaders in that starting rotation that's still going to be really young. But Paxton made it also really clear that this is a place he's comfortable. This is the team that drafted him. He played under Scott Servais before. And even when he got traded, Jerry DePoto told him, hey, when you're a free agent in 2 seasons, keep us in mind. We might want you back. And sure enough, that's what happened. So he's going to have every opportunity to go out there every 6 day, and I also think that having a six-man rotation for him is going to be key because, as you mentioned, injuries have basically been the biggest determinant in James Paxton being maybe a top 15 or top 20 pitcher. He has the stuff to do it, and when he's fully healthy, he can absolutely go out there and dominate when he gets the ball. It's just a matter of keeping him on the rubber.
That's for sure. Just that, about 7 million Yankee fans could chime in about that just from last year. let's wrap with a hypothetical. There's a guy who ended 2 jinxes that lasted a combined 194 years with the Red Sox and then the Cubs. And, of course, I speak of Theo Epstein. So based on what was said on ESPN 710's, I guess last week, reality-wise, what are folks talking about what would it take to get Theo to head to the Great Northwest and try to end another eternal drought?
Yeah, with Theo, the interesting thing is after he left the Cubs, he kind of made it clear that the only way he saw himself returning to an MLB team would be if he had some sort of stake in ownership. And with the Mariners having that open president CEO role after Kevin Mather was dismissed for his comments earlier last month, that's something they could absolutely do. Kevin Mather had an ownership role or an ownership stake along with his president role. I'm not sure if he still has that ownership stake or if that's going to be revoked or sold off in the wake of what ended up happening with him. But that's absolutely something that the Mariners could do and really should do, because Theo Epstein 100% would be the best man for the job. As you mentioned, he got the Red Sox curse broken as the GM when he was the president of the Cubs. Same thing, broke that streak back in 2016 when they won the World Series. And for a Mariners team that's struggling a bit with culture in the wake of these Kevin Mather comments and are really under the microscope, one of the best guys that you could have in all of baseball to come in and kind of help clean up that image and work alongside Jerry DePoto and Scott Servais would be Theo Epstein. I know that right now he's working in Rob Manfred, the MLB commissioner. He's working in his office as a consultant for on-field matters in relation to baseball. But if something happens where the Mariners could throw at him a hefty salary and an ownership stake, then, it could get pretty interesting. But I do think that ultimately that hire needs to come from out of the building. I don't think they can promote anyone from within, given what Mather said and this kind of stigma around the team that his comments might have some merit in terms of representing the organization. The team's made it very clear that they don't think what Mather said represented the organization and that what he said was his own thoughts, but there's always going to be that thought in the back of your head. And with free agency, that's going to be a tough selling point if teams are kind of only reading the news headlines.
Pike's Peak Epstein. Keep an eye on that. Folks, as always, A-plus information is insight from Brandon. On Twitter, use at the B Gustafson online, 710sports.com. Brandon, can't tell you how much I always appreciate you taking the time to join us. Always enhances the program. Be well, and obviously look forward to catching up soon down the road.
You got it. Thanks, Steve.
All right, take it easy.